experience the joy of being heard, of being understood. In her book, Turkle presents anthropological case studies that highlight the same flight from conversation that was captured by the quantitative studies cited earlier in this chapter, and in doing so, she puts a human face on the decreased well-being that occurs when conversation is replaced with connection. Turkle, for example, introduces her readers to middle school students who struggle with empathy, as they lack the practice of reading facial cues that comes from conversation, as well as a 34-year-old colleague who comes to realize her online interactions all have an exhausting element of performance that have led her to the point where the line between real and performed is blurring. Turning her attention to the workplace, Turkle finds young employees who retreat to email because the thought of an unstructured conversation terrifies them, and unnecessary office tensions that fester when communication shifts from nuanced conversation to ambiguous connection. During an appearance on the Colbert Report, host Stephen Colbert asked Turkle a profound question that gets at the core of her argument. Don't all these little tweets, these little sips of online connection, add up to one big gulp of real conversation? Turkle was clear in her answer. No, they do not. As she expands, face-to-face conversation unfolds slowly. It teaches patience. We attend to tone and nuance. On the other hand, when we communicate on our digital devices, we learn different habits. As a true digital minimalist, Turkle approaches these issues from a standpoint of smarter use of digital communication tools, not blanket abstention. My argument is not anti-technology, she writes. It's pro-conversation. She's confident that we can make the necessary changes to reclaim the conversation we need to thrive, noting that despite the seriousness of the moment, she remains optimistic that once we recognize the issues in replacing conversation with connection, we can rethink our practices. I share Turkle's optimism that there's a minimalist solution to this problem, but I'm more pessimistic about the magnitude of effort required. Toward the end of her book, Turkle offers a series of recommendations, which center in large part on the idea of making more space in your life for quality conversation. The objective of this recommendation is faultless, but its effectiveness is questionable. As argued earlier in this chapter, digital communication tools, if used without intention, have a way of forcing a trade-off between conversation and connection. If you don't first reform your relationship with tools like social media and text messaging, attempts to shoehorn more conversation into your life are likely to fail. It can't simply be digital business as usual, augmented with more time for authentic conversation. The shift in behavior will need to be more fundamental. To succeed with digital minimalism, you have to confront this rebalancing between conversation and connection in a way that makes sense to you. To prime your thinking along these lines, however, I'll present a somewhat radical solution, a philosophy of sorts for socializing in a digital age that I personally find to be appealing. I refer to this philosophy by the superfluously alliterative name, conversation-centric communication. You can moderate these ideas as needed to accommodate the idiosyncratic realities of your social life, or reject them altogether. But you cannot avoid the need to think about solutions to these issues that are comparably aggressive. Many people think about conversation and connection as two different strategies for accomplishing the same goal of maintaining their social life. This mindset believes that there are many different ways to tend important relationships in your life, and in our current modern moment, you should use all tools available, spanning from old-fashioned face-to-face talking to tapping the heart icon on a friend's Instagram post. The philosophy of conversation-centric communication takes a harder stance. It argues that conversation is the only form of interaction that in some sense counts toward maintaining a relationship. This conversation can take the form of a face-to-face meeting, or it can be a video chat or a phone call, so long as it matches Sherry Turkle's criteria of involving nuanced analog cues, such as the tone of your voice or facial expressions. anything textual or non-interactive, basically all social media, email, text, and instant messaging, doesn't count as conversation and should instead be categorized as mere connection. In this philosophy, connection is downgraded to a logistical role. This form of interaction now has two goals: to help set up and arrange conversation, or to efficiently transfer practical information, e.g. a meeting location or time for an upcoming event. Connection is no longer an alternative to conversation. It's instead its supporter. If you subscribe to conversation-centric communication, you might still maintain some social media accounts for the purposes of logistical expediency, but gone will be the habit of regularly browsing these services throughout your day, sprinkling likes and short comments, or posting your own updates and desperately checking for the feedback they accrue. With this in mind, there would no longer be much purpose in keeping these apps on your phone, where they will mainly serve to undermine your attempts at richer interaction. They would instead more productively reside on your computer, where they're occasionally put to specific use. Similarly, if you adopt conversation-centric communication, you'll still likely rely on text messaging services to simplify information gathering, or to coordinate social events, or to ask quick questions, but you'll no longer participate in open-ended, ongoing text-based conversations throughout your day. The socializing that counts is real conversation, and text is no longer a sufficient alternative. Notice, in true minimalist fashion, conversation-centric communication doesn't ask that you abandon the wonders of digital communication tools. On the contrary, this philosophy recognizes that these tools can enable significant improvements to your social life. Among other advantages, these new technologies greatly simplify the process of arranging conversation. When you unexpectedly find yourself free on a weekend afternoon, a quick round of text messages can efficiently identify a friend available to join you for a walk. Similarly, a social media service might alert you that an old friend is going to be in town, prompting you to arrange a dinner. Innovations in digital communication also provide cheap and effective ways to banish the obstacle of distance in seeking conversation. When my sister was living in Japan, we would regularly converse over FaceTime, deciding to place a call based on the same spur-of-the-moment inspiration with which you might casually drop in on a relative living down the street. At any other period of human history, this capability would be considered miraculous. In short, this philosophy has nothing against technology, so long as the tools are put to use to improve your real-world social life, as opposed to diminishing it. To be clear, conversation-centric communication requires sacrifices. If you adopt this philosophy, you'll almost certainly reduce the number of people with whom you have an active relationship. Real conversation takes time, and the total number of people for which you can uphold this standard will be significantly less than the total number of people you can follow, retweet, like, and occasionally leave a comment for on social media, or ping with the occasional text. Once you no longer count the latter activities as meaningful interaction, your social circle will seem at first to contract. This sense of contraction, however, is illusory. As I have argued throughout this chapter, conversation is the good stuff. It's what we crave as humans and what provides us with the sense of community and belonging necessary to thrive. Connection, on the other hand, though appealing in the moment, provides very little of what we need. In the early days of adopting a conversation-centric mindset, you might miss the security blanket of what Stephen Colbert astutely labeled little sips of online connection, and the sudden loss of weak ties to the fringes of your social network might induce moments of loneliness. But as you trade more of this time for conversation, the richness of these analog interactions will far outweigh what you're leaving behind. In her book, Sherry Turkle summarizes research that found just 5 days at a camp with no phones or internet was enough to induce major increases in the camper's well-being and sense of connection. It won't take many walks with a friend or pleasantly meandering phone calls before you begin to wonder why you previously felt it was so important to turn away from the person sitting right in front of you to leave a comment on your cousin's friend's Instagram feed. Whether or not you accept my proposed philosophy of conversation-centric communication, I hope you do accept its motivating premise. The relationship between our deeply human sociality and modern digital communication tools is fraught and can produce significant issues in your life if not handled carefully. You cannot expect an app dreamed up in a dorm room or among the ping-pong tables of a Silicon Valley incubator to successfully replace the types of rich interactions to which we've painstakingly adapted over millennia. Our sociality is simply too complex to be outsourced to a social network or reduced to instant messages and emojis. Any digital minimalist must confront this reality and manage his or her relationship with these tools accordingly. I'm an advocate for deploying a conversation-centric approach for this purpose, because I fear any attempt to maintain a two-tier approach to conversation, combining digital communication with old-fashioned analog conversation, will ultimately falter. That being said, others might be stronger than I am when it comes to maintaining a healthy balance between these two interactive magisterium. So I'll resist the urge for dogmatism on this point. The key is the intention behind what you decide, not necessarily its details. To aid this minimalist pondering, this chapter ends with a collection of concrete practices to help you reclaim conversation. My now standard caveats apply. These suggestions are neither comprehensive nor obligatory. They instead provide you with a sense of the types of decisions you can make to help move back toward the type of communication we're adapted to crave. Practice. Don't click like. Contrary to popular lore, Facebook didn't invent the like button. That credit goes to the largely forgotten Friend Feed service, which introduced this feature in October 2007. But when the massively more popular Facebook introduced the iconic thumbs up icon 16 months later, the trajectory of social media was forever changed. The initial announcement of the feature, posted by a corporate communications officer named Kathy Chan in the winter of 2009, reveals a modest motivation for the innovation. As Chan explains, many Facebook posts attracted a large number of comments that were all saying more or less the same thing, e.g., great, or I love it. The like button was introduced as a simpler way to indicate your general approval of a post, which would both save time and allow the comments to be reserved for more interesting notes. As I explored in the first part of this book, from these humble beginnings, the like feature evolved to become the foundation on which Facebook rebuilt itself from a fun amusement that people occasionally checked to a digital slot machine that began to dominate its users' time and attention. This button introduced a rich new stream of social approval indicators that arrive in an unpredictable fashion, creating an almost impossibly appealing impulse to keep checking your account. It also provided Facebook much more detailed information on your preferences, allowing their machine learning algorithms to digest your humanity into statistical slivers that could then be mined to push you toward targeted ads and stickier content. Not surprisingly, almost every other successful major social media platform soon followed FriendFeed and Facebook's lead and added similar one-click approval features to their services. In the context of this chapter, however, I don't want to focus on the boon the like button proved to be for social media companies. I want to instead focus on the harm it inflicted to our human need for real conversation. To click like, within the precise definitions of information theory, is literally the least informative type of non-trivial communication, providing only a minimal one bit of information about the state of the sender, the person clicking the icon on a post, to the receiver, the person who published the post. Earlier, I cited extensive research that supports the claim that the human brain has evolved to process the flood of information generated by face-to-face interactions. To replace this rich flow with a single bit is the ultimate insult to our social processing machinery. To say it's like driving a Ferrari under the speed limit is an understatement. The better simile is towing a Ferrari behind a mule. Motivated by the previous observations, This practice suggests that you transform the way you think about the different flavors of one-click approval indicators that populate the social media universe. Instead of seeing these easy clicks as a fun way to nudge a friend, start treating them as poison to your attempts to cultivate a meaningful social life. Put simply, you should stop using them. Don't click like. Ever. And while you're at it, stop leaving comments on social media posts as well. No "so cute" or "so cool." Remain silent. The reason I'm suggesting such a hard stance against these seemingly innocuous interactions is that they teach your mind that connection is a reasonable alternative to conversation. The motivating premise behind my conversation-centric communication philosophy is that once you accept this equality, despite your good intentions, the role of low-value interactions will inevitably expand until it begins to push out the high-value socializing that actually matters. If you eliminate these trivial interactions cold turkey, you send your mind a clear message. Conversation is what counts. Don't be distracted from this reality by the shiny stuff on your screen. As I mentioned before, you may think you can balance both types of interaction, but most people can't. Some worry that this sudden abstention from social media nudges will annoy people in their social circle. One person I mentioned this strategy to, for example, expressed concern that if she didn't leave a comment on a friend's latest baby picture, it would be noted as a callous omission. If the friendship is important, however, let the concern about this reaction motivate you to invest the time required to set up a real conversation. Actually visiting the new mom will return significantly more value to both of you than adding a short "aww" to a perfunctory scroll of comments. If you couple this push toward more conversation with a blanket warning to your circle that you're not using social media much these days, you'll effectively insulate yourself from most complaints this policy might create. The person cited previously, for example, ended up bringing a meal to her new mother friend. This one act strengthened the relationship and increased well-being more than 100 quick social media reactions could have. Finally, it's worth noting that refusing to use social media icons and comments to interact means that some people will inevitably fall out of your social orbit. In particular, those whose relationship with you exists only over social media. Here's my tough love reassurance. Let them go. The idea that it's valuable to maintain vast numbers of weak-tie social connections is largely an invention of the past decade or so. The detritus of overexuberant network scientists spilling inappropriately into the social sphere. Humans have maintained rich and fulfilling social lives for our entire history without needing the ability to send a few bits of information each month to people we knew briefly during high school. Nothing about your life will notably diminish when you return to this steady state. As an academic who studies and teaches social media explained to me, I don't think we're meant to keep in touch with so many people. To summarize, the question of whether or not you continue to use social media as a digital minimalist and on what terms is complicated and depends on many different factors. But regardless of what final decisions you make along these lines, I urge you, for the sake of your social well-being, to adopt the baseline rule that you'll no longer use social media as a tool for low-quality relationship nudges. Put simply, don't click and don't comment. This basic stricture will radically change for the better how you maintain your social life. Practice. Consolidate texting. A major obstacle in attempting to shift your social life from connection back to conversation is the degree to which text communication, be it delivered through SMS, iMessage, Facebook Messenger, or WhatsApp, now pervades the very definition of friendship. Sherry Turkle, who has been studying phone use since the beginning of the smartphone era, describes this reality as follows. Phones have become woven into a fraught sense of obligation in friendship. Being a friend means being on call, tethered to your phone, ready to be attentive, online. In the last practice, I recommended that you stop interacting with friends through social media likes and comments. This might raise some eyebrows, but with enough apologetic shrugging and a commitment to replace these low-value clicks with higher-value conversation, the change will be accepted. For many people, however, leaving the world of text messaging would prove substantially more disruptive. Friendship doesn't require Facebook likes, but if you're below a certain age, it does seem to require texting. To shirk your duty to be on call in this way would be a serious abdication. This state of affairs presents a quandary. Earlier in this chapter, I argued that text messaging is not sufficiently rich to fulfill our brain's craving for real conversation. The more you text, however, the less necessary you'll deem real conversation, and perversely, when you do interact face-to-face, your compulsion to keep checking on other interactions on your phone will diminish the value you experience. We're left, then, with a technology that's required in your social life, while simultaneously reducing the value you derive from it. As someone who is keenly aware of these tensions, I want to offer a compromise that respects both your obligation to be on call and your human craving for real conversation. Consolidate texting. This practice suggests that you keep your phone in Do Not Disturb mode by default. On both iPhones and Android devices, for example, this mode turns off notifications when text messages arrive. If you're worried about emergencies, you can easily adjust the settings so calls from a selected list, your spouse, your kid's school, do come through. You can also set a schedule that turns the phone to this mode automatically during predetermined times. When you're in this mode, text messages become like emails. If you want to see if anyone has sent you something, you must turn on your phone and open the app. You can now schedule specific times for texting, consolidated sessions in which you go through the backlog of texts you received since the last check, sending responses as needed, and perhaps even having some brief back-and-forth interaction before apologizing that you have to go, turning the phone back to Do Not Disturb mode, and continuing with your day. There are two major motivations for this practice. The first is that it allows you to be more present when you're not texting. Once you no longer treat text interactions as an ongoing conversation that you must continually tend, it's much easier to concentrate fully on the activity before you. This will increase the value you get out of these real-world interactions. It might also provide some anxiety reduction, as our brains don't react well to constant disruptive interaction. See the previous chapter on the importance of solitude. The second motivation for this practice is that it can upgrade the nature of your relationships. When your friends and family are able to instigate meandering pseudo-conversations with you over text at any time, it's easy for them to become complacent about your relationship. These interactions give the appearance of close connection, even though in reality they're far from this standard, providing a disincentive to invest more time in more meaningful engagement. On the other hand, if you only check your text messages occasionally, this dynamic changes. They're still able to send you questions and get back a response in a reasonable amount of time, or send you a reminder and be sure that you'll see it. But these more asynchronous and logistical interactions no longer give off the approximate luster of true conversation. The result is that both of you will be more motivated to fill this void with better interaction, as the relationship will seem strained in the absence of back-and-forth dialogue. Being less available over text, in other words, has a way of paradoxically strengthening your relationship, even while making you, slightly, less available to those you care about. This point is crucial, because many people fear that their relationships will suffer if they downgrade this form of lightweight connection. I want to reassure you that it will instead strengthen the relationships you care most about. You can be the one person in their life who actually talks to them on a regular basis, forming a deeper, more nuanced relationship than any number of exclamation points and bitmapped emojis can provide. This all being said, the practice of consolidating texting might still cause trouble. If people are used to grabbing your attention at any time, then your new absence will cause occasional consternation. But these concerns are easy to resolve. Simply tell people close to you that you check texts several times a day, so if they send you something, you'll see it shortly, and that if they need you urgently, they can always call you. It's here that you should configure your Do Not Disturb mode settings to let in calls from a favored list. This response calms any legitimate concerns about your availability while still freeing you from an unrelenting duty to your messages. To conclude, let's agree on the obvious claim that text messaging is a wonderful innovation that makes many parts of life significantly more convenient. This technology only becomes a problem when you treat it as a reasonable alternative to real conversation. By simply keeping your phone in Do Not Disturb mode by default, and making texts something you check on a regular schedule, not a persistent background source of ongoing chatter, you can maintain the major advantages of the technology while sidestepping its more pernicious effects. Practice. Hold conversation office hours. For over a century, the telephone has provided a way to engage in high-quality conversation over long distances. This remarkable achievement helped satisfy social cravings in an age where we no longer spent our whole lives in tight-knit tribes. The problem with phones, of course, is the inconvenience of placing calls. Without being able to see the person you're about to interrupt with a request to chat, you have no way of knowing whether or not your interaction will be well received. I still vividly remember my childhood anxiety when placing calls to friends, not knowing who from their family would pick up and how they would feel about the intrusion. With this shortcoming in mind, we should perhaps not be surprised that as soon as easier communication technologies were introduced, text messages, emails, people seemed eager to abandon this time-tested method of conversation for lower-quality connections. Sherry Turkle calls this effect phone phobia. Fortunately, there's a simple practice that can help you sidestep these inconveniences and make it much easier to regularly enjoy rich phone conversations. I learned it from a technology executive in Silicon Valley who innovated a novel strategy for supporting high-quality interaction with friends and family. He tells them that he's always available to talk on the phone at 5:30 p.m. on weekdays. There's no need to schedule a conversation or let him know when you plan to call. Just dial him up. As it turns out, 5:30 is when he begins his traffic-clogged commute home in the Bay Area. He decided at some point that he wanted to put this daily period of car confinement to good use, so he invented the 5:30 rule. The logistical simplicity of this system enables this executive to easily shift time-consuming, low-quality connections into higher-quality conversation. If you write him with a somewhat complicated question, he can reply, "I'd love to get into that. Call me at 5:30 any day you want." Similarly, when I was visiting San Francisco a few years back and wanted to arrange a get-together, he replied that I could catch him on the phone any day at 5:30 and we could work out a plan. When he wants to catch up with someone he hasn't spoken to in a while, he can send them a quick note saying, "I'd love to get up to speed on what's going on in your life. Call me at 5:30 sometime." His close friends and family members, I assume, have long since internalized the 5:30 rule and probably feel more comfortable calling him on a whim than they do other people in their circles, as they know he's available then and always happy to take their call. This executive enjoys a more satisfying social life than most people I know, even though he works in demanding technology startups that take up a lot of his time. He hacked his schedule in such a way that eliminated most of the overhead related to conversation, and therefore allowed him to easily serve his human need for rich interaction. Perhaps not surprisingly, I want to propose here that you follow his lead. This practice suggests that you follow the aforementioned executive's example by instating your own variation of his conversation office hours strategy. Put aside set times on set days during which you're always available for conversation. Depending on where you are during this period, these conversations might be exclusively on the phone, or could also include in-person meetings. Once these office hours are set, promote them to the people you care about. When someone instigates a low-quality connection, say a text message conversation or a social media ping, suggest they call or meet you during your office hours sometime when it is convenient for them. Similarly, once office hours are in place, it's easy to reach out proactively to people you care about and invite them to converse with you during these hours whenever they're next available. I've seen several variations of this practice work well. Using a commute for phone conversations, like the executive introduced previously, is a good idea if you follow a regular commuting schedule. It also transforms a potentially wasted part of your day into something meaningful. Coffee shop hours are also popular. In this variation, you pick some time each week during which you settle into a table at your favorite coffee shop with the newspaper or a good book. The reading, however, is just the backup activity. You spread the word among people you know that you're always at the shop during these hours, with the hope that you soon cultivate a rotating group of regulars that come hang out. I first witnessed this strategy in a coffee shop in a town near where I grew up. There's a small group of late middle-aged men who set up shop on Saturday mornings and pull friends into their conversational orbit as they stop in the shop throughout the day. Taking a page out of the English cultural playbook, you can also consider running these office hours once a week during happy hour at a favored bar. I've also seen people deploy daily walks for this purpose. Steve Jobs was famous for his long strolls around the tree-lined Silicon Valley neighborhood where he lived. If you were in his inner circle, you could expect invitations to join him for what was sure to be an intense conversation. Ironically, for the inventor of the iPhone, Jobs was not the type of person who would be interested in maintaining important relationships through ongoing drips of digital pings. In my own life as a professor, I transformed my actual office hours into something broader. In my field, you're required to put aside some time once a week for students in your classes to stop by to ask questions. Early in my career at Georgetown, I realized these sessions held value well beyond just interacting with my current students. I now try to expand the length of my office hours so I can declare them open to all Georgetown students. When any student writes me to ask a question or request advice or share their experience with one of my books, I can point them to my regular office hours and say, "Stop by or call any time." And they do. The result is that I'm much better connected to the student body at my university than I would be if I were still trying to arrange a custom-scheduled interaction for every request that came my way. The conversation office hours strategy is effective for improving your social life because it overcomes the major obstacle to meaningful socializing, the concern, mentioned previously, that unsolicited calls might be bothersome. People crave real conversation, but this obstacle is often enough to prevent it. If you remove it by holding conversation office hours, you'll be surprised by how many more of these rewarding interactions you can now fit into your normal week. 6. Reclaim leisure. Leisure and the good life. In his Nicomachean Ethics, compiled in the 4th century BC, Aristotle tackles a question as urgent then as it is today. How does one live a good life? The Ethics divides its answer across 10 books. Much of the first 9 focus on what Aristotle calls practical virtues, such as fulfilling your duties, or acting justly when faced with injustice, and courageously when faced with danger. But then, in the 10th and final book of the Ethics, Aristotle steps back from this gritted-teeth heroic virtue and makes a radical turn in his argument. The best and most pleasant life is the life of the intellect. He concludes, "This life will also be the happiest." As Aristotle elaborates, a life filled with deep thinking is happy because contemplation is an activity that is appreciated for its own sake. Nothing is gained from it except the act of contemplation. In this offhand claim, Aristotle is identifying, for perhaps the first time in the history of recorded philosophy, an idea that has persisted throughout the intervening millennia and continues to resonate with our understanding of human nature today. A life well lived requires activities that serve no other purpose than the satisfaction that the activity itself generates. As the MIT professor Kiran Setia expands in his modern interpretation of the ethics, if your life consists only of actions whose worth depends on the existence of problems, difficulties, needs, which these activities aim to solve, you're vulnerable to the existential despair that blooms in response to the inevitable question, is this all there is to life? One solution to this despair, he notes, is to follow Aristotle's lead and embrace pursuits that provide you a source of inward joy. In this chapter, I call these joyful activities high-quality leisure. The reason that I'm reminding you here of their importance to a well-crafted life, an idea that dates back over 2,000 years, is that I've become convinced that to successfully tame the problems of our modern digital world, you must both understand and deploy the core insights of this ancient wisdom. To explain my claimed connection between high-quality leisure and digital minimalism, it's useful to first highlight a related phenomenon. Those of us who study the intersection of technology and culture are well-read in the small but popular journalistic subgenre in which the author describes the experience of taking a temporary break from modern technologies. These intrepid souls almost always report that the disconnection generates a feeling of emotional distress. Here, for example, is the social critic Michael Harris describing his experience spending a week without the internet or cell service in a rustic cabin. By the end of day two, I miss everyone. I miss my bed and my television and Kenny and dear old Google. I stare hopelessly for an hour at the ocean, a coruscating kind of liquid metal. I feel the urge to change the channel every 10 minutes. But the same water goes on and on like a decree. Torture. This distress is often explained in the terminology of addiction, in which it can be cast as withdrawal symptoms experienced by an addict. I remember that this was never going to be easy, that withdrawal symptoms are to be expected, writes Harris about his experience at the cabin. But this interpretation is problematic. As we explored in part one of this book, the psychological forces that lead us to compulsively use technology are typically best understood as moderate behavioral addictions, which can make technology very alluring when it's around, but aren't nearly as severe as chemical dependency. This explains why this distress is often described as more diffuse and abstract than the strong and specific cravings felt by a substance addict going through classic withdrawal. It's not that Harris had a specific online activity that he really missed, like a smoker without his cigarettes. It's instead that he was uncomfortable about not having access in general. This distinction is subtle, but it's also crucial for understanding the productive connection between Aristotle and digital minimalism. The more I study this topic, the more it becomes clear to me that low-quality digital distractions play a more important role in people's lives than they imagine. In recent years, as the boundary between work and life blends, jobs become more demanding, and community traditions degrade, more and more people are failing to cultivate the high-quality leisure lives that Aristotle identifies as crucial for human happiness. This leaves a void that would be near unbearable if confronted, but that can be ignored with the help of digital noise. It's now easy to fill the gaps between work and caring for your family and sleep by pulling out a smartphone or tablet and numbing yourself with mindless swiping and tapping. Erecting barriers against the existential is not new. Before YouTube, we had, and still have, mindless television and heavy drinking to help avoid deeper questions. But the advanced technologies of the 21st century attention economy are particularly effective at this task. Harris felt uncomfortable, in other words, not because he was craving a particular digital habit, but because he didn't know what to do with himself once his general access to the world of connected screens was removed. If you want to succeed with digital minimalism, you cannot ignore this reality. If you begin decluttering the low-value digital distractions from your life before you've convincingly filled in the void they were helping you ignore, the experience will be unnecessarily unpleasant at best and a massive failure at worst. The most successful digital minimalists, therefore, tend to start their conversion by renovating what they do with their free time, cultivating high-quality leisure before culling the worst of their digital habits. In fact, many minimalists will describe a phenomenon in which digital habits that they previously felt to be essential to their daily schedule suddenly seemed frivolous once they became more intentional about what they did with their time. When the void is filled, you no longer need distractions to help you avoid it. Inspired by these observations, the goal of this chapter is to help you cultivate high-quality leisure in your own life. The three sections that follow each explore a different lesson about what properties define the most rewarding leisure activities. These are followed by a discussion of the somewhat paradoxical role new technology plays in these activities, and then a collection of concrete practices that can help you get started cultivating these high-quality pursuits. The Bennett Principle. A useful place to start investigating high-quality leisure is within the so-called FI community. For those who are unfamiliar with this trend, the acronym FI stands for Financial Independence, which refers to the pecuniary state in which your assets produce enough income to cover your living expenses. Many people think of FI as a goal you reach around retirement age, or perhaps after receiving a large inheritance. But in recent years, the internet helped fuel a newly resurgent FI community that consists mainly of young people who are finding shortcuts to this freedom through extreme frugality. Most of the attention on the FI 2.0 movement focuses on its underlying financial insights, but these details are not relevant for our purposes. What does matter is the fact that these financially independent young people provide particularly good case studies for exploring high-quality leisure. There are two reasons for this claim. First, and perhaps most obvious, when you achieve FI, you suddenly have many more leisure hours to fill than the average person. The second reason is that the subversive decision to pursue FI at a young age, which typically leads to radical lifestyle decisions, self-selects for individuals who are unusually intentional about how they live their lives. This combination of abundant free time and commitment to intentional living makes this group an ideal source of insight into effective leisure. Let's start this search for insight by interrogating the habits of the informal leader of the FI 2.0 movement, a former engineer named Pete Aidney, who became financially independent in his early 30s and now blogs about his life under the purposefully self-deprecating moniker Mr. Money Mustache. When Pete became financially independent, he didn't fill his life with the types of passive leisure activities we often associate with young men relaxing, playing video games, watching sports, web surfing, long evenings at the bar. He instead leveraged his freedom to become even more active. Pete doesn't own a television and doesn't subscribe to Netflix or Hulu. He occasionally rents a movie on Google Play, but for the most part, his family doesn't use screens to provide entertainment. Where he does spend most of his time is working on projects, preferably outside. Here's how Pete explains his leisure philosophy on his blog. I never understood the joy of watching other people play sports, can't stand tourist attractions, don't sit on the beach unless there's a really big sandcastle that needs to be made, and I don't care about what the celebrities and politicians are doing. Instead of all this, I seem to get satisfaction only from making stuff. Or maybe a better description would be solving problems and making improvements. In recent years, Pete renovated his family's home and then built a standalone outbuilding in their yard to serve as an office and music studio. These projects completed, and eager for more holes to dig and drywall to hang, he somewhat impulsively bought a run-down retail building on the main street of his hometown of Longmont, Colorado. He's currently transforming it into what he calls Mr. Money Mustache World Headquarters. What exactly he plans to do with the space once finished isn't yet quite clear, but the end goal isn't really the point. He seems to have invested in this building in large part for the project. As Pete summarizes his leisure philosophy, if you leave me alone for a day, I'll have a joyful time rotating between carpentry, weight training, writing, playing around with instruments in the music studio, making lists, and executing tasks from them. We can find a similar commitment to action in the lifestyle of Liz Thames, who also reached financial independence in her early 30s and blogs about it on the popular Frugal Woods website. Upon achieving FI, Liz and her husband, Nate, pushed their enjoyment of activity to a new extreme, leaving their home in bustling Cambridge, Massachusetts, and moving onto a 66-acre homestead sited on the side of a small mountain in rural Vermont. As Liz explained to me when I asked her about this decision, moving to a homestead of this size was not a choice made lightly. Their long gravel driveway, for example, requires constant maintenance. If a tree falls, it needs to be sawed and removed, even if it's 10 below outside. If it's snowing, they must plow often, or the snow pile will become too deep for the tractor to push, trapping them on their property, which is not ideal, as their nearest neighbor is a long hike away, and they don't have cell service to let them know they need help. Liz and Nate heat their home with wood from their property, which also turns out to require quite a bit of effort. "We spend the whole summer harvesting wood," Liz told me. "You have to go into the forest, identify the trees to bring down. Then you have to buck the logs, bring them on site, split them, stack them, while also being careful to monitor the wood stove as it heats. And, as it turns out, if you want to enjoy cleared fields surrounding your house, you have to mow a lot." Pete and Liz emphasize a perhaps surprising observation. When individuals in the FI community are provided large amounts of leisure time, they often voluntarily fill these hours with strenuous activity. This bias toward action over more traditional ideas of relaxation might strike some as needlessly exhausting, but to Pete and Liz, it makes perfect sense. Pete, for his part, offers three justifications for his strenuous life. It doesn't cost much money, it provides physical exercise, and it's good for his mental health. "For me, inactivity leads to a depressive boredom," he explains. Liz offers similar explanations for her decision to adopt the demands of rural living. She has a different name for these activities, virtuous hobbies, and emphasizes that activities that can seem like work actually offer multiple levels of benefits. Consider, for example, the effort required to clear trails on their wooded property. As Liz told me, "We have property, we want to hike it, we have to clear trails to do this effectively, so we have to get out there with a chainsaw, cutting trees, clearing brush." This sounds like work, but it offers several different types of value. As Liz explained, "It is mentally freeing, because it is very different than working on a computer. It requires problem solving, but in a different way. In addition, it offers good exercise, and it requires you to learn new skills." "Learning to use a chainsaw is not easy," Liz told me. Finally, there's the satisfaction of actually getting to use the trail once cleared. As explained by Liz, a seemingly tedious task like clearing trails can suddenly seem significantly more rewarding than passively surfing Twitter. The FI community, of course, is not the first to discover the inherent value in active leisure. Speaking to the Hamilton Club in Chicago in the spring of 1899, Theodore Roosevelt famously said, "I wish to preach not the doctrine of ignoble ease, but the doctrine of the strenuous life." Roosevelt practiced what he preached. As president, Roosevelt regularly boxed, until a hard blow detached his left retina, practiced jiu-jitsu, skinny-dipped in the Potomac, and read at the rate of one book per day. He was not one to sit back and relax. A decade later, Arnold Bennett took up the cause of active leisure in his short but influential self-help guide, How to Live on 24 Hours a Day. In this book, Bennett notes that the average London middle-class white-collar worker putting in an 8-hour day is left with 16 additional hours during which he is as free as any gentleman to pursue virtuous activity. Bennett argues that the waking half of these hours could be dedicated to enriching and demanding leisure, but were instead too often wasted by frivolous, time-killing pastimes, like smoking, pottering, caressing the piano, but not actually playing, and perhaps deciding to become acquainted with a genuinely good whiskey. After an evening of this mindless boredom busting, the Victorian equivalent of idling on your iPad, he notes, you fall exhausted into bed, with all the hours you were granted, gone like magic, unaccountably gone. Bennett argues that these hours should instead be put to use for demanding and virtuous leisure activities. Bennett, being an early 20th century British snob, suggests activities that center on reading difficult literature and rigorous self-reflection. In a representative passage, Bennett dismisses novels because they never demand any appreciable mental application. A good leisure pursuit, in Bennett's calculus, should require more mental strain to enjoy. He recommends difficult poetry. He also ignores the possibility that some of this leisure time might be reduced by childcare or housework, as he was writing only for men, who in Bennett's early 20th century middle-class British world, of course, never needed to bother with such things. This is all to say, for our 21st century purposes, we can ignore the specific activities Bennett suggests. What interests me, instead, is a more timeless piece of Bennett's argument, in which he fights the claim that his prescription of strained effort is too demanding to qualify as leisure. What? You say that full energy given to those 16 hours will lessen the value of the business 8? Not so. On the contrary, it will assuredly increase the value of the business 8. One of the chief things which my typical man has to learn is that the mental faculties are capable of a continuous hard activity. They do not tire like an arm or a leg. All they want is change, not rest, except in sleep. This argument reverses our intuition. Expending more energy in your leisure, Bennett tells us, can end up energizing you more. He's reworking the old entrepreneurial adage, "You have to spend money to make money," into the language of personal vitality. This idea, which for lack of a better term we can call the Bennett principle, provides a plausible foundation for the active leisure lives we've encountered so far in this section. Pete Adney, Liz Thames, and Theodore Roosevelt all provide specific arguments for their embrace of strenuous leisure. But these arguments all build on the same general principle, that the value you receive from a pursuit is often proportional to the energy invested. We might tell ourselves there's no greater reward after a hard day at the office than to have an evening entirely devoid of plans or commitments. But we then find ourselves, several hours of idle watching and screen tapping later, somehow more fatigued than when we began. As Bennett would tell you, and Pete, and Liz, and Teddy would confirm, if you instead rouse the motivation to spend that same time actually doing something, even if it's hard, you'll likely end the night feeling better. Pulling together these different strands, we identify our first lesson about cultivating high-quality leisure. Leisure lesson number 1. Prioritize demanding activity over passive consumption. On craft and satisfaction. Any conversation about high-quality leisure must eventually touch on the topic of craft. In this context, craft describes any activity where you apply skill to create something valuable. To make a fine table out of a pile of wood boards is an act of craft, as is knitting a sweater from a skein of yarn or renovating a bathroom without the help of contractors. Craft doesn't necessarily require that you create a new object. It can also apply to high-value behaviors. Coaxing a pleasing song out of a guitar or dominating a game of pickup basketball also qualifies. These definitions of craft can also apply to the digital world, where activities like computer programming or video gaming similarly require skill, but we should put an asterisk next to this final category for now. We'll return to it soon and unpack some of its complexities. My core argument is that craft is a good source of high-quality leisure. Fortunately, when it comes to supporting this argument, treatises on the value of craft are numerous, starting with John Ruskin and the Arts and Crafts Movement, and continuing through the Modern Maker community. There have been thousands of books and articles written on the topic. For our narrow purposes, a good starting place is Gary Rogowski, a furniture maker based in Portland, Oregon. In 2017, Rogowski published a book titled Handmade, which is part craftsman memoir and part philosophical investigation of craft itself. What makes Handmade particularly relevant to our discussion is that Rogowski specifically investigates the value of craft in contrast to the lower-skilled digital behaviors that dominate so much of our time, a purpose revealed by his book's subtitle, Creative Focus in the Age of Distraction. Rogowski provides several arguments for the value of craft in a world increasingly mediated by screens, but I want to underscore one of these arguments in particular. People have the need to put their hands on tools and to make things. We need this in order to feel whole. As Rogowski explains, long ago, we learned to think by using our hands, not the other way around. As our species evolved, in other words, we did so as beings that experience and manipulate the world around us. We are orders of magnitude better at doing this than any other animal, and this is true due to complex structures that evolved in our brains to support this ability. Today, however, it's easier than ever before to power down these circuits. Many people experience the world largely through a screen now, Rogowski writes. We live in a world that is working to eliminate touch as one of our senses, to minimize the use of our hands to do things except poke at a screen. The result is a mismatch between our equipment and our experience. When you use craft to leave the virtual world of the screen and instead begin to work in more complex ways with the physical world around you, you're living truer to your primal potential. Craft makes us human, and in doing so, it can provide deep satisfactions that are hard to replicate in other, dare I say, less hands-on activities. The philosopher-mechanic Matthew Crawford is another useful source of wisdom on the value of craft-based leisure. After earning a PhD in political philosophy from the University of Chicago, Crawford took a quintessential knowledge work job, running a think tank in Washington, D.C. He soon grew disenchanted with the oddly disembodied and ambiguous nature of this work, so he did something extreme. He quit to start a motorcycle repair business. He now alternates between building custom motorcycles in his garage in Richmond, Virginia, and writing philosophical tracts on meaning and value in the modern world. From his unique vantage, as someone who has spent time working in both virtual and physical spaces, Crawford is particularly eloquent in describing the unique satisfactions of the latter. They seem to relieve him of the felt need to offer chattering interpretations of himself to vindicate his worth. He can simply point. The building stands. The car now runs. The lights are on. Boasting is what a boy does who has no real effect in the world. But craftsmanship must reckon with the infallible judgment of reality, where one's failures or shortcomings cannot be interpreted away. In a culture where screens replace craft, Crawford argues, people lose the outlet for self-worth established through unambiguous demonstrations of skill. One way to understand the exploding popularity of social media platforms in recent years is that they offer a substitute source of aggrandizement. In the absence of a well-built wood bench or applause at a musical performance to point toward, you can instead post a photo of your latest visit to a hip restaurant, hoping for likes, or desperately check for retweets of a clever quip. But as Crawford implies, these digital cries for attention are often a poor substitute for the recognition generated by handicraft, as they're not backed by the hard-won skill required to tame the infallible judgment of physical reality, and come across instead as the boasts of a boy. Craft allows an escape from this shallowness, and provides instead a deeper source of pride. With these advantages established, we can now return to our earlier asterisk on the claim that purely digital activities can also be considered craft. There's clearly an argument to be made that skilled digital behaviors generate satisfaction. I made this point in my book Deep Work, where I noted that a deep activity like writing a piece of computer code that solves a problem, a high-skill effort, yields more meaning than a shallow activity like answering emails, a low-skill effort. This being said, however, it's also clear that the specific benefits of craft cited here are grounded in their connection to the physical. While it's true that a digital creation can still generate the pride of accomplishment, both Rogowski and Crawford imply that activities mediated through a screen exhibit a fundamentally different character than those embodied in the real world. Computer interfaces and the increasingly intelligent software running behind the scenes are designed to eliminate both the rough edges and the possibilities inherent in directly confronting your physical surroundings. Typing computer code into an advanced integrated development